night and you closed the door behind you. Were you walking in your sleep or were you just too tired to notice all the watchful eyes upon you? There's the man who does the maintenance and the maid who cleans the carpets in the hall. And the guard down in the lobby through a hidden TV camera saw it all.
Calling. This is White Aryan Resistance Radio. Tom Metzger right here in the bunker. Terrible Tommy right here next to Terrible Tommy's Terrible Tavern and Steakhouse and Filling Station, where we still sell ethyl gasoline and standard. Yeah, it's the only place around this state you can get it. How about that? And we're right next to our weapons of mass destruction used equipment yard, where we rebuild them, recondition them, pound out the dents, bondo them up, paint them, and you come on down here with your 18-wheeler all summer, and we'll sell them to you. Spring, too, if it warms up, and fall. But in the wintertime, we close up and just hang around the bar and sing songs. That's it, you know. Ethel's the barmaid there, and we've had some people comment on Ethel. There's two kinds of Ethel. There's Ethel Gasoline and Ethel the barmaid, yeah. The date is September the 9th, 2014, Tuesday. We got a full moon. Yeah, got up last night and thought all the lights were on in the house. I looked out, we had a full moon, man, a big, beautiful full moon. Yeah, we're at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. That's where you send your donations to keep this hee-haw station going, man. Yeah, that's where you send it. And also, any donations for POWs. We're going to get some more money orders out the next couple of days to the boys. We got, I sent out a message that Matt Hale had sent to his mother, a POW up there, and he said that he'll answer all the letters. And if something happens, you don't get a reply, send another note, because sometimes mail gets lost. But he says he's all set to answer all your letters to Matt Hale. So don't do anything crazy. Don't talk crazy talk. Just try to keep the guy in good spirits and like that. Don't say things that may get him in trouble or get you in trouble, like I'm putting a file in a cake and having it delivered UPS. You know, there's a show on the internet, been on there quite a while, called The Young Turks. And the guy that runs the show, his name is Sink. I believe he is originally from Turkey. However, he does twist the tail on the politicians pretty good. And this is quite interesting, this little clip I'm going to play about how the right reverend got on to MSNBC and got this guy bumped. And this guy, of course, is 10 times as good as the right reverend there, shopped and So, listen to this.
And then with Juan Gonzalez.
We turn now to media news. After giving a nearly six-month tryout to for the Internet talk show host Cenk Uygur, the cable news channel MSNBC is preparing to instead award its 6 p.m. primetime slot to the Reverend Al Sharpton. MSNBC President Phil Griffin offered Uygur a well-paid but lower-profile on-air slot, but Uygur rejected the offer, saying the decision to demote him was politically motivated. Uygur is known for aggressively interrogating leading Washington figures and challenging the political establishment, which he alleges made some MSNBC executives uneasy. On his Internet talk show, The Young Turks, Uygur described what happened last April when Griffin called him into his office.
I got pulled in, and they told me, hey, listen, it was actually one specific person, the head of MSNBC. He said, I was just in Washington, and people in Washington tell me that they're concerned about your tone. I was like, whoa.
Uygur said Griffin also reminded him that the channel was part of the establishment, so he must conduct himself accordingly. This is not the first time a journalist has accused MSNBC of applying subtle yet clear pressure to shape its political programming. Jessica Yellen covered the White House for MSNBC and ABC News in 2002 and 2003 at the outset of the Iraq War. In 2008, she told Anderson Cooper that news executives meddled with how she covered the war.
I think the press corps dropped the ball at the beginning. When the lead-up to war began, the press corps was under enormous pressure from corporate executives, frankly, to make sure that this was a war that was presented in a way that was consistent with the patriotic fever in the nation and the president's high approval ratings. And my own experience at the White House was that the higher the president's approval ratings, the more pressure I had from news executives, and I was not at this network at the time, but the more pressure I had from news executives to put on positive stories about the president. I think over time...
You had pressure from news executives to put on positive stories about the president?
Not in that exact... They wouldn't say it in that way, but they would edit my pieces, they would push me in different directions, they would turn down stories that were more critical and try to put on pieces that were more positive. Yes, that was my experience.
And in that case, she was talking about the Bush administration. That was Jessica Yellen, former White House correspondent for MSNBC. We invited MSNBC to join us today, but they declined. However, MSNBC spokesperson Jeremy Gaines did provide us with the following statement. Quote, Cenk's claims are completely baseless. In fact, we were working on a new contract to develop him into an even bigger television talent. We did have numerous conversations with Cenk about his style, not substance. It's unfortunate he decided to depart in such a negative fashion, he wrote. Dan Pfeiffer, the White House communications director, said Wednesday in an email to the New York Times that his staff did not raise any concerns about Cenk Uygur's show with Phil Griffin or anyone else at MSNBC. So, well, Cenk Uygur's joining us himself from Los Angeles to speak for himself. In addition to his recent primetime talk show on MSNBC, Cenk Uygur blogs at several liberal websites and hosts a popular internet and radio show called The Young Turks. Cenk, welcome to Democracy Now! What happened?
Well, it's exactly as I explained on The Young Turks. I was going along doing the program. You know, they did have early on some stylistic comments. I was trying to listen to them, you know, in terms of body language, don't wave your arms, act like a senator. I don't know why you'd want a talk show host to act like a senator, but fine, it's the medium that you're working in. If I'm working on the internet, and you know, it's different than working on television. And you know, taking those points is no problem at all. But in April, when they pulled me in, Phil Griffin gave me this big speech about how we're the establishment, and it'd be cool to be like outsiders, but we're not. We're insiders, and we have to act like it. And I remember thinking at the time, well, there's no way I'm going to do that. So I'm going to give them what I got. And then if they like it, they like it. If they don't, they don't. And honestly, I didn't know which way they were going to go with it because I know how much they care about ratings. So I figured if I delivered good ratings, that would probably do the job. Well, it didn't because I delivered really good ratings, beating CNN significantly, handily, and also improving upon the numbers from last year. So there's no question about the ratings. And then they pulled me in and said, we're going to go in a different direction at 6 o'clock anyway. And when I asked them about it, they didn't really have a good answer as to why, leading me to believe that that giant conversation we had 3 months ago might have been part of the reason.
In December of last year, Phil Donahue joined Elliot Spitzer and Kathleen Parker on their show to discuss his ouster from MSNBC. During the run-up to the invasion of Iraq, Donahue was the lone journalist daring to publicly oppose the war at its onset.
I opposed the war.
And was that one of the reasons they pushed you off?
Oh, read the memo published by the New York Times.
So
Donahue's anti-war voice is not going to work against the flag waving on the other station. Donahue, an anti-war voice in 2002.
Right.
Remember, they're all doing what I did
now.
I mean, the whole channel is now. You could not criticize this war 4 months before the invasion.
Right.
It was not good for business. You had General Electric had no interest in featuring an old talk show host who was against the president's war. It was unpopular. You weren't American. This is what you get with corporate media. It's going to happen again.
Cenk Uygur, does your situation compare to that of Phil Donahue's? Do you think Al Sharpton would take a very different political line than you would?
So there's a couple of different things here. First of all, it's not just Phil Donahue. I had Jesse Ventura on the Young Turks a little while ago, maybe over a year ago. And what people don't remember is that he also had a big contract from MSNBC at the time to do a show. And they told him, you know what, it's okay. Take the money. You don't even have to do the show. Why? He said they found out that he was against the Iraq war and said, that's okay. We don't want you on air then. Okay? And Ashley Banfield, when she gave a great speech in Kansas about how the war didn't make any sense, she went from their star reporter to literally being moved into a closet. And they wouldn't even let her out of her contract so she can go on another network and talk. It was unbelievable. Now, the distinction there is Donahue, Ventura, Banfield were all under different management at MSNBC. So you have to be clear on that, and you can't put that on them. But the similarity is that it is corporate media, right? And whether it's the pressure to go right, the pressure to go left, pressure to appease the Bush administration, or pressure to appease the Obama administration, it exists. And it's not just MSNBC. You think that the CNN host can aggressively challenge government officials? I don't think so. It doesn't look that way at all. And, of course, when you get to Fox News, they're a whole different animal. They're purely propaganda.
And
so, to me, this is not an issue of just MSNBC management now. No.
But, Cenk, also, there are several liberal hosts still on MSNBC, but they also managed to be basically very supportive of the Obama administration. You were perhaps one of the most critical hosts in terms of raising questions about the Obama administration's policies.
Well, there's no question that I was by far the least supportive of the Obama administration. I saw your last segment, and I couldn't agree more with your guests. I think President Obama is clearly, you know, a Republican. I know, because in the 1990s, I was a Republican, and he's way to the right of me, and I've hardly changed any positions. The political spectrum has shifted massively to the right in this country, and nobody wants to talk about it. And the Obama, supporters, I don't know what they want the host to do. So we fought so hard to make sure that Bush didn't cut Social Security. So are we supposed to cheer when Obama cuts Social Security? We fought so hard to make sure that Bush didn't give more tax cuts to the rich. Are we supposed to cheer when Obama gives more tax cuts to the rich? And the list goes on and on. Now, it's very important for me to make this distinction because I really believe it. The hosts are totally different than the management. And it is an interesting way that you acquire power within these corporate organizations, right? I think Rachel Maddow has done a brilliant job in becoming more and more independent, and I think she does a fantastic progressive show, and she did it by accruing power, by getting better and better ratings. So my beef is not with anybody on air at MSNBC at all. I think Ed Schultz does a strong show.
Cenk, we only have 20 seconds. I want to ask you, MSNBC said they were offering you a better position. Can you respond to that?
Well, better is in a lot more money, but it was for weekend hosting and for a contributor role.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Go ahead, 5 seconds.
So it's not like there was a disgruntled employee or not. I just didn't want to do the kind of programming they wanted me to do.
Cenk Uygur, I want to thank you for being with us, the Young Turk. This is Democracy Now!
You might wonder why I played that for you, but I'm sure that most of the people listening to this show know exactly what the game is in this country as far as the media is concerned. Now, this is what they do to professionals that are actually, for the most part, on their side, even though they have their little tiffs once in a while. So you can imagine why we never have a spokesman to talk about our racial views or anything else on television or radio hardly ever. And so they decided that was too risky because we were making too much sense. And that's the reason that I and many other leaders or people who speak well and that were on TV for quite a while got froze out. It was simply came down from the top. And to say specifically Jews, no, I won't say that. There are plenty of Jews involved. But I think the right wing of the racial struggle many times go a little bit too far in that direction. I think that there's plenty of white Christian corporate leaders out there of these networks who are doing the same thing as the Jews. So I think that this is a trap that a lot of right-wingers get into to where, here again, you know, it's all the Jews, all the Jews, all the Jews. Well, you know, when the Jews do bad, condemn the hell out of them, but you're going to have to include all these Christian Zionists and these other people who are simply in it for the money in the media. These corporations are simply out to make money. And you can't hardly tell the truth on TV or radio if they don't make money out of it. So anyhow, so they got Al Sharpton, which is the most ridiculous thing I ever heard of. I don't know whether they're trying to attract the black watchers and listeners. I just don't make sense to put Al Sharpton on there. Well, let's go over to the Ukraine here for just a glimpse of how screwed up this is. Quote, officials in Kiev say the militias and the army coordinate their actions, but the militias, which count about 7,000 fighters, are angry and it's sometimes uncontrollable. One known as Azov, which took over the village of Marinka, flies a neo-Nazi symbol resembling a swastika as its flag. The conservative London Telegraph offers more details about the Azov Battalion in an article by correspondent Tom Parfit, who wrote, Kiev's use of volunteer paramilitaries to stamp out the Russian-backed Donetsk and Luhansk People's Republics should send a shiver down Europe's spine. Quote, recently formed battalions such as Donbas, Dnieper, and Azov, with several thousand men under their command, are officially under the control of the Interior Ministry. But their financing is, and that's the Internal Ministry of Ukraine, but their financing is murky and their training inadequate and their ideology often alarming. The Azov men use the neo-Nazi wolf's angel, wolf's hook symbol on their banner, and members of the battalion are openly white supremacists or anti-Semites. Well, I question why they're there if that's what they are. Based on interviews with militia members, the Telegraph reported that some of the fighters doubted the Holocaust. Oh, my goodness. Oh, run for the hills. Somebody doubted the Holocaust, expressed admiration for Adolf Hitler, and acknowledged that they are indeed Nazis. My question is why they aren't fighting on Russia's side. Russia's full of National Socialists. They're all over the place in Russia. So this is these so-called neo-Nazis coming out of Britain and Sweden and Denmark and wherever the hell they're coming from, are not showing a united front from true National Socialism. And I don't see any reason why true National Socialist would want to put themselves in a position of fighting on the side of the EU and the Jews in the EU. And I believe the premier of Ukraine is Jewish. He's a rich billionaire, I understand. So this is what screws up any kind of advancement in the National Socialist program, or as I would call it, racial socialism. They're talking about these racial socialists talking terrible and insulting about the Russians. The same old stuff that they made the mistake of doing in World War II. They're doing it all over again on a smaller scale. Andriy Beletsky, the Azov commander, quote, is also head of the extremist Ukrainian group called the Social National Assembly, unquote, according to Telegraph articles, which quoted a recent commentary by Beletsky as declaring that, quote, the historic mission of our nation in this critical moment is to lead the white races of the world in a final crusade for their survival, a crusade against the Semite-led Untermensch. Well, what they're doing down there doesn't seem to me like anything that is a mission as a final crusade for the white race. They should be combining with their Russian brethren, National Socialists or Racial Socialists, and not being involved on either side on this deal. The Telegraph questioned the Ukrainian authorities in Kiev, who acknowledged that they were aware of the extremist ideology of some of the militias, but instead that the higher priority was having troops who were strongly motivated to fight. In other words, people who go out and maybe have fun killing. And you see, this is totally distorting the situation in the Ukraine. And also, it's getting a hell of a lot of people killed, white Ukrainians. And this is a ridiculous situation. And I see there's guys on here that I've talked to that are in Russia. And they go extreme one side, and these other guys go extreme the other. So what kind of a racial front as a racial crusade could this possibly be? And, of course, these guys could not possibly, in Ukraine, refer to themselves as National Socialists, because, I mean, it would have been like been like Germany fighting on the side of Marxist Russia or something like that. So it don't make any sense. So anyhow, we need a lot more voice from racial socialists or national socialists of the real kind, the kind that was around before Germany became a racial capitalist country and then brought on the war and all that kind of stuff. So I've told you before, you can't trust any world leader. You just can't do it. And most of them are involved in war crimes and treason, as was Nixon. This is from the book Chasing Shadows. One of America's great political mysteries continues to come into sharper focus. Did Richard Nixon sabotage President Lyndon Johnson's Vietnam peace talks in 1968 to win that election? And did Nixon's fear of exposure lead him to create the burglary team that got caught in a Watergate 72? And one thing while I'm thinking about it, a lot of people don't know that the Paris peace talks, Kissinger promised, I think, several hundred million dollars or maybe $1 billion to Vietnam to rebuild Vietnam. And after they got the agreement and the war was over, Vietnam never got the money. So they're always double dealing, these people. Pieces of this puzzle began to fall into place even in real time as Beverly Deep, the Christian Science Monitor Saigon reporter, got wind of Nixon's treasury before the 1968 election, although her editors spiked her article when they couldn't get confirmation in Washington. In the ensuing years, other journalists and historians began assembling the outlines of Nixon's peace talk sabotage, with the story getting its first big flash of attention when Seymour Hersh made references to it in his 1983 biography of Henry Kissinger, The Prince of Power. Then in 2012, investigative reporter Robert Perry discovered that Johnson's long-missing file on Nixon's 68 operation which was later turned over to the Johnson Library, helped explain another mystery: why Nixon launched his plumbers operation in 71 and thus set in motion a series of burglaries that led to the Watergate scandal. Nixon had been told by FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover that Johnson had evidence from wiretaps about Nixon's peace talk sabotage, but an alarmed Nixon couldn't find the file, whose absence became critical after the Pentagon Papers' history of the Vietnam War was teaked in 71. Nixon knew there was a potential sequel somewhere that could end his presidency. Now, journalist Ken Hughes, a resident scholar of the Miller Center at the University of Virginia, has filled out a story even more in his book, Chasing Shadows, The Nixon Tapes, The Chenault Affair, and The Origins of Watergate. Hughes begins his book with the dramatic day of March the 31st, 1968, when President Johnson announced on national television he would not run for re-election that fall. Or as he put it, "I shall not seek and I will not accept the nomination of my party for another term as your president." But Johnson said something else. He intended to end the Vietnam War before leaving the White House. Since his election in 64, Johnson had overseen a massive military escalation of the war, inserting 550,000 American troops in theater and ordering the greatest bombing campaign in the history of warfare called Rolling Thunder. Of course, he faked that Gulf of Tonkin incident so he could escalate the war. Despite all the carnage, Johnson finally concluded that a military victory in Vietnam was illusory. He therefore announced a limited bombing halt over 90% of North Vietnam and promised a complete bombing halt if the North Vietnamese would show some reciprocal restraint. Though many Vietnam War critics were dubious about Johnson's peace initiative, the historical record is now clear that Johnson was sincere about his plan. He wanted peace talks to begin as soon as possible. He was seeking a U.S. exit strategy. As Hughes notes, there had always been advisors around Johnson who told him it was futile to fight in Vietnam. As early as 1964, Senator Richard Russell of Democrat of Georgia advised his former protege, quote, "It isn't important a damn bit. I never did want to get messed up down there. I do not agree with those brain trusters who say this thing has tremendous strategic and economic value and that we'll lose everything if we lose Vietnam." Russell said the problem was how to get out of Vietnam without looking weak, a dilemma that Johnson, a classic cold warrior who believed in the domino theory, could not overcome. But the war's futility and its political damage had become apparent to Johnson by the time the Viet Cong's Tet Offensive in January-February 1968, leading to his decision to withdraw from the presidential race and his plan to end the war. Johnson also sought to be fair to major candidates running to replace him, Vice President Hubert Humphrey, former Vice President Richard Nixon, and independent candidate George Wallace of Alabama. Johnson promised to keep them equally informed of developments in the peace process. And Hughes writes that as far as the declassified record reveals, Johnson kept that promise. But the political problem from Johnson's peace initiative soon grew acute for Nixon, who remained bitter about his narrow loss to John Kennedy in 1960. Well, he should have been, because that was given to him by the mayor of Chicago. Mayor Richard Daley is the one who got him the votes he needed. Anyhow, during the late summer of 1968, Nixon had a big lead over Humphrey, swelling to about 15 points after the disastrous Democratic convention in Chicago. A lot of you people don't remember the big riots, anti-war riots at the Democrat convention in 68. But Nixon recognized that Democrats were likely to unify, especially if the anti-war faction thought that Johnson was making progress on the peace deal. Humphrey also began reaching out to disaffected Democrats with increasingly clear overtones on resolving the war. Johnson could deliver a full bombing halt and start of a U.S. withdrawal. Nixon might again be denied his dream of the presidency. Whatever one thinks of Richard Nixon, the man had the deserved reputation of a consummate infighter in the political arena. This went back to his smearing of Congressman Jerry Voorhees in 1946, sort of hinting that Voorhees might be a communist or something. I remember part of that. Of course, I was pretty young at the time. His 1948 to 1950 destruction of State Department diplomat Alger Hiss from Nixon's seat on the House Committee on Un-American Activities and his tarring of senatorial candidate Helen Gaglin Douglas in 1950. In fact, now declassified Nixon tapes that Hughes cited, Nixon admits that he unethically had access to grand jury proceedings against Hiss, which he used to convince Hiss in the press before trial. Well, Hiss turned out to be definitely guilty of being a communist agent. There's no doubt about that. Whitaker Chambers, who had been a fellow traveler, he condemned Hiss and outed him. Thus, Nixon might have viewed Johnson's peace initiative as just one more political obstacle to overcome. And Nixon had his campaign apparatus people like China lobby figure Anna Chenault, who could sink Johnson's negotiations by getting the South Vietnamese government to stay away from the Paris peace talk. Yeah, well, Anna Chenault was the wife of the military Air Force commander Claire Chenault. A friend of mine met with him one time. He wrote a book. Met him down in San Diego. I never got to meet him. Anna Chenault was the widow of legendary Flying Tigers pilot Claire Chenault. I think she was an Asian, but I'm not sure. I don't remember for sure. Who was 32 years her senior when they were married in 47. The Chenaults were part of the China lobby, the campaign that smeared President Harry Truman and the Democrats for losing China to the communists in 1949. The Chenaults also suffered financially with the fall of China since they were planning to run the CIA-related airline Civil Air Transport under Chiang Kai-shek, but the operation was forced to move to Taiwan. Well, this was a horrible mistake, the way we handled that thing at the end of World War II and dealing with China. Even though China was a communist country, they could have been dealt with, and that would have solved a lot of problems. In fact, even in Vietnam, the leader there, I forgot his name now, but he was actually pro-American. Most of these people have been pro-American, and we screwed them. Our government screwed them. The Chenaults and the China lobby were effective in portraying Democrats as being soft on communism in 1952 election. Chenault died in 1958, but his widow remained active in the Republican politics and in Washington social life. She rented a suite at the Watergate Hotel and became founder of the Flying Tiger Line, a freight loading operation. I'm almost positive she was Asian. Because of the political effectiveness, her wealth, and her status as a woman ethnic, yeah, there you go, Anna Chenault became involved in the 1968 Nixon campaign under the campaign chief John Mitchell, of which you know he was run out of office, and I think that he even did some jail time. He had a wife, Margaret, I think her name was Margaret Mitchell. She was crazier than a loon, and she drove John Mitchell crazy because anybody start talking to her, she'd start blabbing about things she shouldn't have been blabbing about. She was co-chair of the Women's Advisory Committee that raised $250,000 for Nixon, the top sum by a female fundraiser. By early 68, Anna Chenault was already in contact with Bo Dinh, the South Vietnamese ambassador to the United States, about her work for the Nixon camp, according to a memo by Nixon's foreign policy advisor Richard Allen, cited by Hughes. in her 1980 memoir, The Education of Anna, Chennault also described a meeting in New York City involving herself, Bodine, Nixon, and Mitchell on July 12, 1968, a get-together corroborated by Bodine's memoir, In the Jaws of History. At this meeting, Nixon anointed Anna Chennault the sole representative between the Vietnamese government and the Nixon campaign headquarters. And that was a very bad choice as far as affecting our government. As the back channel between Nixon campaign and South Vietnamese government, Chennault passes a series of messages to Bodine, President Thieu, and other senior officials in Saigon. Of course, President Thieu was corrupt as hell, and the CIA finally bumped him off, essentially promising them a better deal if Nixon won. Chennault told Thieu that Diem, that Johnson's peace talks were simply a ploy to get Humphrey elected president, and that Humphrey opposed the Americanization of the war, which was good. Chennault indicated that Nixon favored a more direct American intervention, an appalling, appealing message to convey to Thieu, because without U.S. support, Thieu's regime could not last long against the Viet Cong and North Vietnamese. Well, anyhow, it goes on and on here, and this book is pretty revealing, so it pretty well shows that Nixon, like most other presidents, were traitors to their country. And I make that as a direct challenge that they were, and I think it can be proven that most of our presidents, in one way or another, harm not only the white race, but the whole country. So anyhow, you can take that and or leave it. But any leader of any stripe of any party that gets into dealings that unethically causes thousands of white American lives to be lost in Vietnam are the worst kind of war criminals. And so they're all of, I mean, you know, Nixon, Johnson were war criminals of the worst kind. I mean, after hundreds of thousands of Vietnamese, maybe half a million, had been killed, and all these American troops that had died, for Johnson finally to say he wanted to get a peace thing going doesn't clean his. He'd already committed the horrible crimes of treason. So don't let anybody shit you. Our enemy, our racial enemy, is in the seats of power in the United States. And they're in the seats of power in many other countries, too. And as long as they're there, we'll be losing. As long as they're there, we have no chance of winning. And as long as they're there, we probably have no chance of surviving.
This is the end, beautiful friend.
Didn't even have the decency to bring them all back. There were several hundred of them left there. Probably they're close to death now because of their age and probably working in the rice paddies and so forth, but don't let them kid you. We didn't bring a whole bunch of them, never got back here. That's how much your government loves you. That's how much you should be happy to go put on a uniform and take a gun and fight. You've got enough information now over the last, from the Vietnam War and all that, in the Middle East. You have to be absolutely crazy out of your mind to go into the military. Well, is there any money in religion? Southern pastors are making bigger bucks. Pastors in big southern churches make more than their counterparts anywhere else in the country, reports our own Adele Banks. The next highest paying region is the Northeast, followed by the West and the Midwest. But Canadian pastors do worse than Midwesterners. The pay gap is just one gleaning from a new study of 727 North American churches with attendances ranging from 1,000 to 30,000. But the South wins again. They got their preachers make more than anybody else in the country. I'm not going to comment on why. Well, I can see that big trouble's on the way for India because they've got a religious split down there. India is 80% Hindu and has no official state religion. But Hindu nationalists, emboldened by the election earlier this year of Prime Minister Narendra Modi, are preaching the gospel of an all-Hindu India. Foot soldiers in the movement are volunteers in the, I can't pronounce this name, a vast organization. Reuters reports that aims to convert the entire country to Hinduism. Said one Hindu nationalist activist, at a recent ceremony to convert a Christian family to Hinduism, "We will not let the conspiracy of church or mosque succeed in India." You know, they've had big wars over there. In fact, that's part of what led to this creation of Pakistan, which used to be all part of India. It looks like they're going to be going at it again, and it may be another split. Well, Christian's got a new song out. it's called Jesus Shot Me in the Head. I got it here, but I'm not going to play it. It takes too much time. Jesus Shot Me in the Head. If you want to hear it, you probably can get it up on YouTube. I see some breakaway cleric from the Orthodox Church over there in the Ukraine has called Putin the devil. Said, he is the devil, boy. Poor old Putin. Well, the German government's all upset about the supposed dropping of the ball investigating the so-called Nazi cell that was responsible, allegedly, for some killing over there in Germany. So everybody's shuffling to cover their ass. Listen to this.
German MPs release a damning report into a series of neo-Nazi murders, saying incompetence across the board led to failures in investigating the NSU far-right terrorist cell. The 1,000-page report highlighted 47 areas for improvement for the police, with one MP warning that the danger posed by militant neo-Nazi groups must never again be underestimated.
We have to put in the heads of all our personnel, especially the police, different thought patterns, more intercultural thinking, away from discrimination, and this we can only achieve through training.
Das müssen wir schaffen durch Aus- und Fortbildung.
The police's handling of the case was widely criticized, as the neo-Nazi cell was uncovered by mistake when the ringleader Beate Schepper handed herself in after two members were found dead by police following a botched bank robbery. Schepper is currently on trial for the murders of 10 people, mostly ethnic Turks, over the course of 7 years.
Well, I'm not sure of the ideology of some of these people or not. They're probably traditional Nazis rather than traditional National Socialists. They'd probably be doing things a lot differently if they were traditional National Socialists. First, you have to gain the power and then remove them all from Germany or wherever they're at. That's the way you do that. You can't. You're never going to do it by popping them one at a time on a street corner. You got to get the power and massively repatriate people. Well, a new report prepared by the Ministry of Natural Resources and Environment, circulating in the Kremlin today, states that the Russian environmental scientists have become horrified over the past fortnight, after President Obama opened up for fracking with virtually no public notice and then abruptly auctioned off 21.6 million acres of the most sensitive areas of the Gulf of Mexico to the major U.S. energy companies that had, in effect, paid to put him in office. You know, that's for all these right-wingers that say that he doesn't have big money behind him. And it's only the Republicans. According to this report on 20 August, Obama ordered this Bureau of Ocean Management, BOEM, to conduct an auction of these 21.6 million acres in the Gulf of Mexico at the Mercedes-Benz Superdome in New Orleans, Louisiana, and which afterwards BP America, who was responsible for the 2010 Deepwater Horizon Gulf of Mexico catastrophe, was said to be the big winner. There we go. Crime pays. International crime pays even higher. Of the greatest danger to Obama's allowing fracking in this environmentally sensitive region, this report continues, is that it sits in what is called the Lower Tertiary Basin, which has been coined as the final frontier of oil exploration in the Gulf of Mexico, worth over $1.5 trillion, and is an ancient layer of the Earth's crust made of dense rock, and which is potentially catastrophic for current offshore fracking operations. Like the land-based version, a recent U.S. study report points out offshore fracking involves injecting a mixture of water and chemicals into the seafloor. It is understood to be risky, and the risk poorly understood. In a recent Bloomberg investigation, an engineer at Halliburton, the world's leader in fracking, described deep water drilling as the most challenging, harshest environment that we will be working in. Even when things go right, Emily Jeffers, a staff attorney at the Center for Biological Diversity, explained to Ceylon News Service, there don't seem to have been any studies on the process' potential environmental impacts. A representative of the Environmental Protection Agency confirmed as much to Bloomberg. Well, they're going to do it. Yeah, between nuclear plant possible meltdowns because of earthquakes, these guys are trying to break up the crust of the planet. Who knows what's going to happen? But there doesn't seem to be anybody that's standing in their way. In fact, the president and all these other people, politicians, are all making big money off this situation. They could care less. You know, this Ukrainian thing is getting more complicated all the time, because now I see in reading some very deep articles here that go on that we've got alleged neo-Nazis in Ukraine fighting alleged neo-Nazis from Russia. Oh, man, I'm telling you, this thing gets wilder as it goes along. Well, I wonder what the EU and the, you know, American-backed, of course, EU, NATO, and the big money people are going to do with these so-called neo-Nazis when they're through using them in eastern Ukraine. And I wonder also what Putin will do if he decides he doesn't need these people around, too. I think these people better get back into the mode of pan-Aryanism and that way to go. True national socialism, pan-Aryanism, and don't get hooked up with these central governments at all. Trying to hitch a ride with the ruling class just for a short run, gaining of a little power and money and adventure is a waste of time and counterproductive. I don't see any government today anywhere in the relatively white world that would be worth teaming up with. It just doesn't make any sense. It's counterproductive. I know my vision is much different than what's going on, but this right-wing so-called neo-Nazi stuff is being supported and pushed by the old right-wing, not only in this country, but over in Europe and Russia. So watch out. You know, it wouldn't be the first time that the National Socialists, American National Socialists, were used by the CIA for their own purposes. And for those who say it's not happening, I experienced it. I knew the National Socialists that ended up being working for the CIA. Just like when many people get caught in the drug business, they go immediately to work for the DEA. That's a common practice, that these people are absorbed by the Federals. So what are you fighting for? I mean, you know, what a waste of time that is. But I guess this old right wing in this country is going to have to run its course, because it's still there. They're still putting out a lot of nonsense and still pushing the Hitler worship and all that, and not getting down to brass tacks. Well, that's about it for today, boys and girls. We'll be back with you with some happy news tomorrow. Yeah, and Wotan's Day, David Lane's favorite day. In the meantime, be careful which neo-Nazi group you mess with. In fact, I think you'll be better off not messing with any of them, because if they don't understand that they're either National Socialist or Pan-Aryan Socialist and think they're neo-Nazis, well, there's a lot of other things they don't have right.
With a weekly load, you can smell a whiskey burning down Copperhead Road.